This is Stephanie Walker interviewing Anne Evans at her home in the Plains in Oneonta, New York, on Sunday, November 17, 2013, for the Cooperstown Graduate Program's Oral History Project, which is part of the Research and Fieldwork course. Now, Ms. Evans, I thought we would start with a brief overview of your childhood.
Oh, when I was born, where I was born, that kind of information? Okay, I was born in Southampton, which is in the county of Hampshire in England, in 1931. And I think I lived there with my mother and father. Maybe not my father, he was a merchant seaman, so he was away a great deal of the time, but certainly with my mother and her family. And I remember being moved to live in London with my father and mother and my brother, who was born 13 months after me. His name is Peter. And we moved to Southgate, which is in North London. And that's where I spent time before I went to school at the age of 5, which is the required time that you go to school in England. Not a private school, it was a public school. And I was there until 1939, when the war was starting. And then we went to Wales, North Wales, a place called Llandudno.
Which, World War II?
Yes.
Sorry.
World War II, that is. Mm-hmm. And we left London and went to live in Wales, as I said. And I went to school there. Of course, they only spoke Welsh, which I had no clue what they were saying. It was before the war, things in the country were pretty, unless you were in a town, things were pretty basic. And we had slates to do our work on with the slate pencil. Do you know what slate is?
It's like chalkboard.
Yeah, it's, and then when you want to erase it, you just rub it out. Mm-hmm. So that's where our lessons were recorded. And I didn't gain very much because I didn't understand a word of what was being said. And then from there, I went down to live with my grandmother in Farnham, which is in Surrey. That's in southern England. About an hour and a half from London, in what they call the home counties. She lived in a lovely house. She had moved there because the war came. She didn't want to stay in London where she was living. So I went down there, and then I went into an English school, which had been evacuated from London to a school in that area. A very well-known school. So my education was caught up, if you like. If it is ever caught up, I'm not sure.
What was that like, going from school to school because of the war?
Well, actually, it wasn't bad. I didn't find it disturbing at all. People were very friendly, and everybody was on the move. It wasn't just me. Everybody was in a transition. So I wasn't amongst people who thought that strange, that I had come from another school at that short time. No, everybody was doing that. The whole country was on the move.
You said that it was simple in the school, like what you had. Was that the same with living conditions as well?
Simple?
Like when you talked about the slates?
Oh, it was, when I went to the new school in Farnham, which is where we were, in southern England, it was very ordinary, very sophisticated, if you like, in comparison. There were books and pencils and everything you would require. It was a very fine school and not primitive in any way. By today's standards, it would be exactly what you would find today, as far as the basic requirements.
Could you describe a typical school day?
typical school day. Most children in those days walked to school in England. There were no buses. Totally unheard of, not even thought of. You walked to school, it depended how far you had to walk. I didn't have to walk that far. And when you got into school, you went to the cloakroom where you hung up your clothes, your outdoor clothes, changed your shoes into indoor shoes, and everybody had a shoe bag on their peg under their coat so you could put your outdoor shoes in there. If they were muddy, you put them underneath, but usually you put them in there. Then you went to your classroom just to have attendance. Then everybody went down to school prayers, because in England, school and prayers are not divided like they are here. If you did not want to hear prayers, or your parents did not want you to hear the school prayers, which were Episcopalian, then you could wait outside, or you could stay there and not join in with the hymns or whatever it was. There was no pressure. After that, you'd go to your various classes, depending what it was. They were split up by bells. You hear the bell ring. I imagine it's the same here, I don't know. And then you go to your next class. At 11 o'clock or 11:30 would be break time. And everybody was given, you went to pick it up, one of the areas, a third of a pint of milk. Everybody had that, regardless of family's income. It's in a bottle. You drank it, put the bottle back, went out to play. The end of that, the bell would go and you'd come in for more lessons until lunchtime. There were no school lunches. You had to go home. You have to walk home and have lunch, come back. In the afternoon was mostly games. Now, I played hockey. The boys played soccer. In the summer, it was tennis and rounders, which is similar to your baseball. In fact, baseball came from rounders. And then you'd go home. You might have a lot of homework, you might have none. There wasn't a tremendous amount of homework as I remember it. As you got older, of course, the pressure was there. But I'm talking about being maybe 10 years of age. So that would be a simple day.
And when you say hockey, is that the hockey I'm thinking of?
Field hockey.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I was a school captain. Later, at that time, it was just a wing. I played wing.
Fairly fast. Mm-hmm. What were your obligations as the captain?
Well, you had to keep the team together. There was none of this rah, rah, rah that you get here. None of this... we were interested. Parents were interested, but not what you see here at all. And none of this craziness about I have to be on the school team. My job was to make sure everybody had the right equipment and that they wore it properly and that you observed the rules of the game and worked with the referee. That's all you had to do.
Was there anything else that you did for fun?
I was very interested with horses all my life, so I did a lot of riding, which eventually led to show jumping, which I did when I was a little bit older, say 12. Yes, horses were my life.
Did you live near a farm, or was that...?
I wasn't on a farm, no. I did not live on a farm, but we did have a horse, and we had a donkey, and we had animals, but it was just a suburban property. Quite large, quite a bit of land with a lake. It was very nice.
What got you started with the horses?
What got me started? I was always interested from a very young age. You'd read about horses, you'd read stories like Black Beauty or any of those wonderful stories. So that's what made me interested. But riding in those days is very different from what I see my grandchildren do here, where everything, because of the insurance laws, is so regulated and so boring, quite honestly. riding round and round in a paddock. We didn't do any of that. We went where we wanted, when we wanted. No, unless it was private property, and they said no trespassers. But other than that, you'd ride in the woods, you'd ride in the town. No restrictions. None of these awful rules that they have now. I can understand the rules.
Were you ever in any competitions?
Yes, I did a lot of show jumping, won a lot of prizes. Yes, I was a competitor. We used to take the horses, ponies actually, in a horse box, which is a van, and go all over the place, spend the day, come back. I was very fortunate. I didn't have to really look after the horses. We had a groom at the stables who would do all the brushing and cleaning the tack. It was great fun. We had enormous fun.
Did your friends participate with you?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, you didn't do this on your own. Yeah, friends from school, my cousin who would come up at the weekends from where she was living. She was at a boarding school. She and I started school together at one time. It was a convent, not because of a religious affiliation, but because it was a good school and our parents put us there. She was very naughty. She was expelled because she threw an ink pot at Sister Madeleine, who was one of the teachers. So then she went to a boarding school for girls, which was a nice school. And it shows you how archaic things were in those days. As you went into the property, there was a sign on the gate which said St. Clair's, that was the name of the school, a school for the daughters of gentlemen. Sounds like out of Jane Eyre. But it wasn't. I'm talking about 1942. Seems like the Dark Ages to you, but it's not that long ago. You would never get a sign like that now.
Do you remember any other teachers other than...
Yes, we had a very nice... at another school. I remember Miss Nelson very much. She taught geography. Because in those days, the subjects were taught in slightly differently. We had geography, we had history. We didn't have social sciences or anything like that, where it's all lumped together, is my understanding now. No, everything was divided. And... geography was a favourite subject for me. I liked filling in the rivers, doing the trees, doing where the coal mines were. That was very interested work for me. So yes, I remember her very well.
Do you feel that tied in with the horse riding?
Not particularly.
Could you talk to me about dating when you were younger?
With boys?
Mm-hmm.
Didn't have anything like that specifically. We had friends. I had friends who were both male and female, and we went together as a bunch, really.
Mm-hmm.
I think when I was about... How old was I? I was 16 when I went to my first dance, asked by a boy, and my mother approved.
Mm-hmm.
It was, and in those days it was very different from now. There was a formal dance. Oh, they were all formal. And you wore a long dress. The boy would have to pick you up at the house and take you home. Not like now.
Was it important that your mom approved?
Oh, it was unthinkable. If she just automatically did it. I'm sure there was groups that didn't do that, but in my particular milieu, that's what you did. On one occasion, I had been with a friend, Mary Dorton. We had been over to a town about 15 miles away. We had taken the bus there to do some schooling of the horses. We were going into a show, and there was a trainer there, and we had put the horses there for a week or so, so they had daily training. But we would go after school, take the bus, and go over and do some work. Well, coming home that particular night, I remember quite clearly, we missed the bus, the one we wanted to get back. So we're sitting on the side there, kicking our heels. In those days, it was light until about 11 o'clock because they had double summer time. It didn't go forward 1 hour. It went forward 2 hours. That was to help the farmers get the harvest in or whatever they were doing. So it was daylight, bright light until about 11 o'clock at night. So we felt perfectly safe. Not that we ever felt we weren't safe, but our parents would make us feel, you know, you have to be in at a certain time, which we thought was absurd. Anyway, we're sitting there kicking our heels, and two soldiers came by, because there were soldiers stationed everywhere during the war, in that particular part of England, the southern England. There were big camps everywhere. And they were on motorcycles, motorbikes. One was obviously an officer, the other was private. But anyway, they stopped to talk to us, as soldiers always do, and we thought that was very cool, as you would say today. And then we're still waiting for the bus, and we have conversation, and we're admiring the motorbikes. They were military bikes, not big flashy ones like you have now. And one of them said to me, "Would you like to have a ride?" And like a jerk, very dangerous thing to do, but you know, I said, "Oh, fine, that would be lovely." Got on the back of the bike on the pillion, and we went off, and it was a lovely ride. It was fine. But thinking about that now, anything could have happened, right? And Mary, my friend, she did the same thing. We could have been raped. We could have been murdered. These things happen, and you read about them all the time. Not then, but you do now. Things have so changed. But we went off carefree and had a great time. But then they brought us back safe and sound, still talking, and then the bus came. And we got on the bus, and they said, "Well, where are you going?" We said, "Well, we're going to Alton." That's where I lived. That's where Mary lived. So they followed the bus on their bikes. So when we got off the bus, I then went to walk home, and this one fellow, the officer, walked with me. He said, "I'll come home with you, see you home." I said, "Fine." So we walk home. He leaves the bike at the gate. We had a long drive up to my house. I go in, and my mother said, "Hello." And I explained who this fellow was. I said, "Well, we just met, and he's came back with me." She said, "Oh, that's fine. You go and make tea." She wanted me out of the way. She wanted to speak to him. Obviously, he was fine, because she didn't throw him out and say, "How dare you cost my daughter?" None of that. Became a friend. And he invited me on a couple of occasions to go to dances at the officers' club in Aldershot, which was a big camp. And I agreed to go, and then at the last minute I decided not to go, which was cowardly of me. For some reason, I didn't feel that I could do that, even though he was a nice fellow. And my mother said, "It's fine, he's a nice young man, don't worry about it." I just couldn't. I guess because it wasn't on my territory at home. Mm-hmm. So that was the end of that. But that wasn't a date. It was a pickup, if you like. He picked me up. I went like an idiot. I went with him. Anything could have happened. I mean, I cringe at the thought now. When you're young, you do these things.
Did you ever find out what your mom said to him?
No, not really. I never asked her. I knew I shouldn't. I knew they were chatting. He was probably all of 21. He was a young guy.
How old were you at that time?
About 16, I think.
Could you talk to me about when you met your husband?
I met him at a party, a 21st birthday party, of a mutual man that we both knew, and I didn't know him, but this fellow, Sydney, was having this 21st birthday party, and he invited me to come. And of course I went, and when I was there I was introduced to this fellow, and we got on very well indeed. And then afterwards, Sydney, he's the fellow whose party was at, I thought you and Basil would get on well, and that's why I wanted you to come and meet him. And we did. We eventually got married.
What were your initial thoughts when you first saw him, met him?
Well, he was very presentable. He was tall. He was slender, if you like. He dressed well, had very good shoes, had neat hands, clean fingernails, nicely dressed, was a great sense of fun, told wonderful stories, and was not just into himself. He was into whatever was going on around him. Had a very inquiring mind.
What did your parents have to say about him?
Well, when we got engaged, I was in London. He was a medical student at a very good teaching hospital. I was a nursing student at a very good teaching hospital. So we had a lot in common. And then when we did get engaged, he asked me, he said, but I want to speak to your father. I said, of course. So it was arranged that we go down to where my family were living in Alton. I took the train down and I introduced him, and he spoke to my father. He said, fine, anything to take her off my hands. He didn't say that at all. They were lovely. Everything worked out beautifully. So they liked him very much. And they knew he had good prospects, and he would always be a good provider, which is important to them.
What led to the two of you getting married?
Well, that's what you did in those days. You didn't go and live with somebody. Mm-hmm. You never were alone with them, really, too much. We decided, you know, we'd been together about 2 years. It was about 2 years. And when I finished my nurse's training, I said, okay, we can get married then. He still had his medical degree to get. So he was still a student. And we decided we could do it. So we did. Simple as that. I guess we wanted to sleep together. We couldn't do it before that. Well, of course we could have done, but there was no opportunity. Simply wasn't available.
I'm sorry to backtrack a bit, but you mentioned the war.
Mm-hmm.
Was there any thing specific, how you felt it affected your life?
Well, in actual fact, it was a very ordinary time, because our parents were obviously aware of what was going on. They were very involved in all of that. But they were very calm, and I think children, and certainly my brother and I, were not alarmed by what was going on, because they never showed any kind of alarm. They were very sanguine about everything as far as we were concerned. So I think, as most children, you take that tone from your parents. So although we had an air raid shelter, which everybody did, they were given them. They were called Anderson shelters. They were made out of corrugated iron. They were delivered in pieces, and the family had to dig a foundation, which we did in the back of our property, and you erect it in that. So you went down into a shelter. And my mother, as most people did, they made them comfortable inside. You had bunk beds, and you had, not candles, because candles can be dangerous, you had lamps with a battery, so you always had to have a good supply of batteries, both outside and inside the shelter, because there were no lights, no street lights allowed, no lights from the houses. Everything was blacked out, so you had to have a little torchlight, and it had to be very battery, a very small one, not a big flashlight, a small flashlight, just enough so you could see where you were going. So batteries were very important, and they were very hard to get. People would buy them and hoard them. There was always a shortage of number 8 batteries. I remember the number. So they made it comfortable. So when the sirens would go, this is when we were living in London before we went to Wales, our parents would get us up and we'd say, time to go to the shelter. So you put on warm clothing, which was always available at the end of your bed, and quickly went down there, and then you got into your bunk bed and you went back to sleep. So it was very, very smooth. There was no panic. Fortunately for us, because there were areas that were very heavily bombed in the Blitz, and that was not that scene at all. And there were lots and lots of families, as you probably have seen reading, that went into the underground, what do you call it here?
The subway system?
Subway, yeah. They slept in the subway on the platforms. They had rows and rows of bunks, tiers of bunks, and they would go down there. And then that became a ritual for them, because they could not stay up above ground when the sirens, when it was, well, horrendous, horrendous. And families became very friendly with other families, so it became sometimes like a bit of a party down there, and the kids would not necessarily be going to sleep, they'd be running around. So yes, for us, it was not a difficult time. I don't know how my mother managed, but she did. We always had food. And when we moved to the country, of course, we didn't have any of that until the doodlebugs came, and then we did. But on the whole, it was pretty exciting, because we had so many troops stationed around us, and they'd be walking around and marching around, and the trucks would go in full of soldiers who'd whistle, you know, any young girl walking around, and that to us was fun. We loved being whistled at. So yes, it wasn't that disturbing.
You mentioned doodlebugs. I don't know what those are.
Oh, well, at the end of the war, the Germans were very clever in inventing rockets. Of course, the rocket program we have now all came from that. And they used to send over a rocket. It was called a doodlebug, for want of a better name. It had an engine, rather like a drone. It was very small, probably a bit larger than that cupboard over there. And it had an engine. And they would fire it from the coast of France, because they had invaded France and taken over France by that time. So they set up the rocket sites there, and they would fire them. Now, you would hear the doodlebug coming, you could hear the motor. You couldn't necessarily see it if it was high up. But if you heard it and you looked up and you heard it, you were safe, because the minute the engine cut out, that's when it would drop. And what it was a flying bomb, actually. So whatever it hit would be destroyed, no matter what it was. Could be a cow's in the field, could be a building, could be anything. So if you heard them coming, you were okay. If you didn't, if it suddenly stopped, you had to run for shelter. Now, that was called a doodlebug, and it was the V2s came after that. The V2s didn't make a sound. They were just rockets, huge rockets, that were bombs again. They would just zoom over and explode anyway. So you never knew. And they were very frightening. Where we were okay, because they weren't aimed at our area. Occasionally you'd get the stray one, but that was because the rocket didn't do what it was supposed to do. It went in the wrong direction. And as you know, mechanical things don't always work as they're supposed to. So if the mechanism wasn't tuned exactly, they could go anywhere. And that was the V1. They didn't have a nickname, but the doodlebug, you know, they were made fun of to make everything light and less menacing. You make a joke of things.